Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll talk to Antioch University's new chancellor, Felice Noodleman. Ellen Belcher has this week's Politics Ohio. Bill Felker clarifies the living world around us with Poor Will's Almanac. And coming up, ML Schultze from WKSU reports on a special letter that was auctioned off this week, written by Mary Todd Lincoln. All that and more up first. Changing Landscapes is the first exhibition of contemporary Chinese fiber art to travel to the United States. This weekend marks the opening of the exhibition tour's only Midwestern stop at the Dayton Art Institute. WISO's Juliet Fromholt has more.
When you enter the first gallery of the Changing Landscapes exhibit, you see classic tapestries depicting Chinese landscapes. The exhibit quickly unfolds to display both traditional and modern uses of embroidery, printing, and sculpture that tackle the idea of landscape literally and figuratively. Three large bamboo boxes covered in colored fiber make up a piece called Balminess. Artist Bai Jin was a student in China when she created it. Guest curator Lisa Morissette explains that the sculpture was the end result of a long creative process.
The artist here had tried to render this space of her childhood memory in many different medium, and it was finally this technique that she developed herself, creating these boxes, and the largest of them weighs 65 pounds. They are bamboo and a variety of different fibers and corn.
Morissette says that pieces like Balminess take a less traditional approach, but still portray a strong sense of landscape.
I think this evokes not a picture of a place as much as the colors of your memory, the textures, even sound. For some reason, sound really comes out clearly to me in the memory of place in this work.
The artists featured in Changing Landscapes are either students or teachers from higher education institutions throughout China. Three generations are represented, and many of the works deal with the social and economic changes that have transformed China over the past decade. Professor Niyu Hung's Floating House depicts modern architecture floating against a brightly woven background.
And yet the whole thing is askew and sort of appears to be sinking into this.
Again, guest curator Lisa Morissette.
And Professor Niyu has really talked about the experience of trying to have home. Home ownership in China is even more dramatic, in a dramatic state than it is in the United States.
At the end of Changing Landscapes, visitors will also have a chance to see an installation called Flow by American artist Maya Lin. She's best known for designing the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Changing Landscapes and Flow are on display now through June 17th at the Dayton Art Institute. For WISO, I'm Juliet Fromholt.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO. A letter written to a Cleveland man was expected to sell for as much as $40,000 at an auction this week. Its author, Mary Todd Lincoln, is one reason why. But as WKSU's ML Schultze reports, the estimated price was also tied to the signature on the envelope, the photo inside, and the emotion that pours out over four neatly written pages.
In 1998, the fledgling National First Ladies Library in Canton got an offer it had to refuse. A nearly 140-year-old letter of condolence written on blackboarded stationery by Mary Todd Lincoln. A letter filled with anguish, yet seeded with hope. The library's director of education, Lucinda Fraley, says her group was simply in no position to buy.
We didn't have the money at the time. We were so young. Very young. I wasn't here yet. There may have only been a couple of employees. And we had to let it go.
Now the letter's for sale again through a private auction house. It's expected to bring bids of $20,000 to $40,000. And while the library, now part of the National Park Service, is in much stronger financial shape, the letter remains out of its price range. So Fraley says the library can only hope for a loving new owner.
Whoever gets it's going to be just thrilled to have it in their collection. I hope it's a place where people can go and view it, and I know there are private collectors out there, and this was in the hands of a private collector, but such rich history when it's the First Lady's thoughts on something as important as the content of this letter.
Fraley carefully holds even the copy of the letter's words pulled from the auction website, and she reads in the accent of a Kentucky-born child of wealth, which Mary Todd was.
May 5th, 62, Executive Mansion. Mr. Reeves, my dear sir, the sad intelligence of the death of your most excellent wife.
Mary Todd Lincoln was writing this letter to Charles Reeves of Cleveland, Ohio. She offered condolences on the death of his wife, Hester, who had tutored her son, Willie, in Springfield, Illinois, and she was writing less than 3 months after Willie had died of typhoid fever.
And I fully know and believe that they are this day together rejoicing in the presence of their Savior. I have shed many, many tears over the last writing of your sainted wife in memory of our darling boy. If it were not for the hope that by serving God rightly here, we may be enabled to meet them again, what would life be?
The letter was believed to be in the hands of the Reeves' granddaughter until the 1930s, when it was sold, and private collectors have had it since. RR Auction is selling it as part of an auction of 500 pieces of Civil War memorabilia. And RR's Bobby Livingston says the envelope of this letter alone attracts interest.
In those days, the president didn't have to pay for postage. The president just had to sign the outside of the envelope where the stamp normally goes. And so we also have the black-bordered envelope, what we call franked by Abraham Lincoln on the outside. So it's an incredible lot. It's compelling and it's heartbreaking.
What kind of a market is there for something like this? Who's attracted to something like this?
People have been collecting autographs and signatures of famous people for millennium. We actually have autograph requests answered by people like Abraham Lincoln, where he'll write a little letter, here's an autograph per your request, Abraham Lincoln. So people are actually collecting autographs for all these years. And so today, people who love history and want these historic figures to come to life buy things from us. What really I find fascinating is you get to read these handwritten letters, which is really a lost art today, but you know, you're able to go right back in time with Mary Lincoln right during the Civil War. The letter that we have from her is written right after the Battle of Shiloh, and it's very much in parallel to the tearing apart of our country as she tears apart her heart over the loss of her son.
One of Mary Lincoln's four half-brothers died at the Battle of Shiloh, fighting for the Confederacy. Another died in Baton Rouge, and a third was killed in Vicksburg. So Lucinda Fraley says tragedy and mourning were associated with Mary Lincoln long before April 11th, 1865.
The lady was in mourning a lot. And let's face it, her husband, she was sitting in Ford's Theater right beside him, and he fell into her arms. She was there. She witnessed that bloody, awful thing. And when he was taken across the street, Mary Lincoln was not allowed to go into the room. They wouldn't let the First Lady into with her husband. He would have wanted her there. He adored her.
Fraley refers to letters Mary Lincoln wrote years later, after she was declared legally insane. She sees the same careful hand in those letters as she sees in the one addressed on May 5th, 1862, to Charles Reeves of Cleveland, Ohio.
Please excuse this letter written in much haste and almost blotted by my tears. When we weep here, we can only remember that then all tears are wiped away from their eyes. Sorrow never enters there. Your ever sincere friend, Mary Lincoln.
For Ohio Public Radio, I'm M.L. Schulze.
That auction ended Thursday night, and we're not going to leave you hanging. Joining me by phone is Vice President Bobby Livingston with RR Auction House in Amherst, New Hampshire. So, Bobby, tell us how the auction went.
That's right. We had a special themed Civil War auction. It was pretty exciting towards the end, so it was very good.
And more than 500 pieces, I understand.
Yeah, we had over 500 lots related to the North and South, and specifically Abraham Lincoln and Mary Lincoln.
So our listeners just heard the background of this letter, and as you said, the total sum of the items that were auctioned generated a lot of excitement. What kind of response did you see?
We had an intense interest in this letter. When letters of this quality come to the marketplace, they don't come often. So we had a very spirited bidding, and the final tally came to $46,520, which was fantastic.
Can you say who will be receiving that?
The letter is sold to a private collector who risks to remain anonymous. Sometimes museums and institutions do bid in our auctions, but oftentimes, because the auction platform is so sudden, it's difficult for them to put together the funds to purchase things. So we always hope that one of their benefactors or private citizens will get in and buy it and donate it. But in this case, it's going into the hands of one of the finest autograph collections in the country.
Okay, great. And how about just a little bit of background on RR Auctions?
RR Auction was founded in 1980, and every month since then, over 32 years, we've issued a monthly catalog. Our specialty is handwriting. We're handwriting experts and authenticators, so we're kind of the marketplace for fine documents and letters of famous people like Albert Einstein, the Beatles, George Washington, and Mary and Abraham Lincoln.
Bobby Livingston, Vice President with RR Auction in Amherst, New Hampshire. Thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, it's great being with you.
Last week, Antioch University announced that Felice Nudelman was selected as the university's fifth chancellor. She is currently the executive director of education for the New York Times Company, where she's responsible for developing and overseeing education initiatives, including the New York Times Knowledge Network. Before that, she served as executive director for Pace University's School of Education. I spoke to her by phone just a few days ago and wanted to know how that experience will play into her new role at Antioch University.
I'm so excited about joining the Antioch University team and utilizing what I've learned from my many years in higher education before joining the New York Times. I spent some time as a faculty, but quickly moved into the administration, which I loved. I loved being able to work at institutions and to envision the potential, envision how we could best serve students, envision and imagine and implement the types of programs that would serve students and society. And so, although I've spent 11 and a half years at the New York Times, it has all been within the focus of education.
Antioch University is a rather unique entity. It has five campuses around the country, including Antioch Midwest here in Yellow Springs. What are the strengths and weaknesses of this five-campus structure?
Well, I see them as strengths. I see that the ability to have a national university that at its core, at its mission, is to provide a learner-centered education, to empower students with the knowledge and skills to lead meaningful lives and to advance social, economic, and environmental justice. That's a very strong and compelling mission. And as a national university, that speaks to probably some of the greatest needs in our country at this moment in time. When you couple that with very strong campus presence, campuses that are linked to their communities, that are strengthened by their community ties, I think it is a strength. It's an absolute strength. And so I look forward to working with each of the five campuses. The programs are exceptional that they deliver. The faculty are exceptional. And the mission and values are just unparalleled.
So what do you see as the greatest short-term challenge for yourself as the new chancellor?
I see that my immediate role will be to help the university achieve its next level of growth, and we're looking forward to that. Again, we're building on very strong campus presence. We're building on programs that are linked to their communities and understand the value of education as a common good. And we're also at a point where we have the opportunity to have the university grow. And so that's an exciting challenge to face and one that is an energizing challenge.
I believe that you've had experience with online education initiatives, and I was wondering how much online learning is a part of Antioch University's future.
I hope that online learning will be a robust part of Antioch's future. Again, we have very, very strong programs and very strong ties to the community. But the education landscape is growing in exciting ways, and it would be just an incredible opportunity to have Antioch University as a national university with international reach to explore the option and opportunity of online learning. I think, though, that as with any new enterprise, the faculty are key to this. The substance of the curriculum is key. The content of the courses is key. And the need to really maintain the university as a learner-centered university is key. So online learning is just one more way to work with students and for faculty to teach. And so I look forward to that next potential for growth for Antioch.
WYSO Public Radio is licensed to Antioch University, as you know. Do you have any early thoughts on how the university and the radio station can partner to better serve our radio listeners and Antioch students?
Oh, I am so excited about WYSO. I've actually listened to you online, and so I'm I know the station. I know the NPR affiliation, and I know the role that public radio plays in the community. It strengthens those ties, and it is a really exciting opportunity to have such a high quality station affiliated with the university. I've seen the new facility, and I think that the plans to serve the Miami Valley and the community are very exciting. I know that there's live music planned and shows and outreach, additional outreach. And so I think that the more the WYSO interacts with the entire Miami Valley and continues the high quality of broadcasting, the better for both the university and the community. It is a community service.
Felice Nudelman, Executive Director of Education for the New York Times Company, now Chancellor of Antioch University. Felice, thanks for speaking with us.
Jerry, thank you so much for taking the time today. I so look forward to joining the Antioch University team and look forward to being relocated in the Miami Valley in the near future.
WYSO is licensed to Antioch University. Current Chancellor Tony Murdoch will retire in June. Felice Nudelman will begin her term on July 1st. This is WYSO Weekend. If you're really into studying the history of the Indonesian heavy metal scene, or perhaps you'd rather spend your days analyzing golf swings, college may be the place for you. There's a proliferation of unorthodox college majors in Ohio and nationwide. State Impact Ohio's Ida Liefskovsky reports that students seem to like the new range of classes, but critics worry they don't guarantee the best jobs or biggest paychecks.
Students at Ohio State University's professional golf management program often get the same question.
Well, the first thing they always say is that a real major? To which I say, yes it is. And, I mean, obviously everyone thinks it's awesome.
Awesome, maybe. But fourth-year golf management major Bailey Stolarski says people still have their doubts about its practicality.
Just because it's unfamiliar, maybe new, doesn't mean it's any less credible than the next major. I mean, obviously, pre-med and pre-law and whatever you want to say are the standard, you know, difficult majors are great. But, I mean, I've certainly challenged myself since I've been here.
Stolarski says she did worry that studying golf management would be too specialized and limit her job prospects, but learned that it's actually quite a diverse program. It includes classes on sports, business, marketing, and hospitality management. Still, there is quite a bit that's specific to golf, like learning to build your own golf club.
Hook knife to cut the grip off and then clean it.
And then there's the popular culture program at Bowling Green State University, just south of Toledo. The program boasts to be the only place in the country where you can get a bachelor's and master's in pop culture. In a recent class, students discussed the merits of zombie kittens.
If it was like a porcelain cat who was made to look like a zombie, it would be like high culture.
Students here are adamant that this is a tough major. They bristle at suggestions it lacks academic rigor. It's not just watching YouTube videos. It's analyzing them and writing extensively about popular culture theories. Still, senior Becky Dennis concedes there are some concerns about its economic value.
There's definitely a question of what can you do with a pop culture major. I mean, but there's a question of what can you do at this point with any social sciences or humanities majors.
Bowling Green career counselor Casey Farrell-Snyder encourages students to follow their dreams, even if there's a less clear career path for, say, English or philosophy majors.
I still believe that you should do what you love to do and you should major in what you love because, you know, if that person had majored in business instead of English, for example, probably wouldn't have done very well in her classes. I'm guessing. Probably wouldn't have enjoyed it nearly as much. And so then, like, what kind of college experience is that?
I understand that point of view, but I would tell people to try to pick up as many skills and experiences as possible.
That's Lou Horner with the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services. He's tasked with regularly updating a list of the high-wage occupations in demand around the state.
The Buckeye Top 50 is sort of the cream of the crop.
Horner says computer and healthcare-related jobs dominate the Buckeye Top 50. Of course, that doesn't mean everyone should become a doctor or a computer engineer, but Horner says students should be aware of where the jobs are.
I would like people to take a look at that and at least give it some consideration. If they want to be in a particular occupation, that's great, but they need to know sort of what the level of demand for that occupation is.
Remember the student theorizing about zombie felines in the pop culture class? That was sophomore Brittany Nisley. She says she's not too worried about finding a job.
I feel like just the fact that you're getting a college degree is something, because basically you need it to get a job anywhere anymore.
That's largely true, says Jeff Stroll of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. But Stroll and colleagues say what you take in college is even more important, especially if you want the best job prospects or a big fat paycheck.
There is immense variation in the specific majors and the returns to specific majors. A petroleum engineer, you know, has a median earnings of $120,000, and a school counseling psychologist has a median earnings of $29,000. I mean, it is widely varied.
According to Stroll's research, the unemployment rate is best for graduates in the healthcare or education industries, though engineers make the most money. Then again, not everyone is intent on becoming rich, and the world only needs so many petroleum engineers. Oh, and by the way, Ohio State claims 80% of its alumni with such degrees are working in golf management. For State Impact Ohio, I'm Ida Liaskovsky.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. Today I'm talking to Jack Shaner about fracking, a controversial drilling method for extracting oil and natural gas. Jack is a lobbyist and deputy director of the Ohio Environmental Council. He and the Ohio Environmental Council are opponents of fracking and critics of how Ohio is regulating oil and gas companies. Thanks for talking with me, Jack.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ellen.
Let's start by explaining fracking. Ohio is blessed with massive Utica and Marcellus shale deposits, mostly in eastern Ohio. Hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, is a relatively new process whereby millions of gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals are shot a mile or more into the ground to shatter the shale. The resultant fracturing then releases natural gas and oil. What are your biggest concerns about the fracking process?
This is on a scale, a size, a speed that we have never seen before here in Ohio. And with it can come serious risks to our environment and to human health. We need to take special caution, special care to make sure that we're able to safely manage these risks.
Your critics would say that environmental organizations will oppose oil and gas exploration no matter what. Can you conceive of fracking being done safely?
I think that is possible. We need to learn a lot more about it, however. We have called for a moratorium, a timeout, until the United States EPA completes a study that it's currently doing right now at the request of Congress. That study is looking at what are the risks to groundwater, to drinking water. Why plunge ahead headlong and outrun our headlights? Let's make sure we get the proper regulations in place. You know, we've been drilling for oil and gas for years and years in Ohio. We have developed a long record of regulations and have been strengthening those over the years. Well, you know what? Those regulations haven't come about voluntarily. Could be another year here, but guess what? There's some resources that are priceless and are irreplaceable.
Can you briefly tell us what the experience of Pennsylvania has been? I know that the fracking process is well ahead of Ohio there. How has that worked out?
You know, I've heard the oil and gas industry testify at the Ohio State House, and they use the term hiccup. That is, that Pennsylvania really wasn't ready, learned a lot of hard lessons. That's one nice thing of Ohio being down the line following some of these other states. Some of these other states have been a guinea pig, and we can learn from their experience. But there have been reports of people who have had their wells fouled because of contamination. There have been reports of farmers who've livestock have ventured down to some of these open temporary storage pits on the land and have become sick from drinking that water. There are thousands of wells that have been drilled in Ohio. There are thousands of wells more that will be. It is not like every other well has failed. But when things go wrong, they really go wrong.
What is Ohio's Department of Natural Resources, which regulates fracking, not doing that it should be? What authority does it need that it doesn't have?
Imagine that an oil and gas well could be as close as 150 feet from your property line. That is the state law. Think about at a football game, the 150 feet is the distance from the 50-yard line to the goal line. We think that 150 feet is way too cozy. We also want better public notice and comment opportunity. The public should fully have a right to know about and to be able to comment on these kinds of activity.
Governor John Kasich was an eager proponent of fracking, but since the earthquakes, he seems to have cooled a bit. At the same time, he recently announced that he wants to increase taxes on the oil and gas industry to pay for a 5% across-the-board income tax cut for individuals. Talk about the politics of the situation.
Governor Kasich, even before he took office, has been a cheerleader in residence for the oil and gas industry. He's been ballyhooing this potential juggernaut, he believes, of jobs and investment. I got to give him credit, though. He has always said that there are environmental risks, and we need to adequately control that. In the same breath, he's also, in his energy plan, talking about streamlining of permits. This is sends a chill down our back anytime somebody wants to speed up the review process of permits or make it faster, easier, more nimble for industry to get a permit.
I've been talking to Jack Shaner, a lobbyist with the Ohio Environmental Council. Tune in next week when Tom Stewart, the executive vice president of the Ohio Oil and Gas Association and a proponent of fracking, gives his perspective. Thanks for your thoughts, Jack.
Thank you, Ellen.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Well's Almanac for the first week of middle spring. The blooming of bright yellow forsythia bushes always announces the arrival of middle spring. This is the time that the remaining daffodils and grape hyacinths flower, and that wildflower season unfolds in the woods with the blossoming of early violet cress, twinleaf, periwinkle, spring beauty, hepatica and small-flowered bittercress. Early meadow rue and may apples are pushing up out of the ground. Cowslip is budding in the swamp and leaves grow long on the skunk cabbage. Japanese knotweed, columbine, phlox, and lupin emerge in the garden. When you see forsythia shrubs in bloom, then the first buckeye, apple, and peach trees are leafing out. At dusk, the first frogs and toads are singing. Killdeer become common along the roads, and woodcocks call near sunset with a nasal-sounding peent. Barn swallows arrive at the barns, and the first baby barred owl hatches. When forsythia blooms, then farmers are seeding the first of the oats and field corn. In town, the lawn is almost long enough to cut. And then nettles, chicory, and leafcup are 6 to 8 inches tall. Asiatic lilies and columbine 3 to 5 inches. Ragwort and garlic mustard are forming clumps. Some sweet rockets and money plants are getting ready to send out their flower stalks. Hops vines twine around the honeysuckle. Japanese knotweed catches up with the rhubarb, which is just about big enough for pie. Water rushes and purple loosestrife, water lilies and pickerel plants have suddenly produced foliage in the ponds and streams where small diving water beetles hunt for food. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the second week of middle spring. In the meantime, find the yellow flowering forsythia blooming in the city or the country, telling you the time of year.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
You've been listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour.
Person Place Thing starts tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. Person Place Thing puts a twist on the public radio interview show. The idea is that people reveal themselves most intimately when they talk about something they care about, not when they talk about themselves. Interview subjects come prepared to talk about a person, a place, and a thing that they feel strongly about, whether it's love or hate. This structure elicits conversations that wouldn't emerge in a standard interview. It invites the guests to tell stories they never have before. In the next few weeks, we'll hear from food writer Michael Pollan, Daily Show correspondent Samantha Bee, and columnist Dan Savage. But tonight, it's Susie Essman, the comedian, author, and actor, best known for her role on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Susie Essman's person is her grandma Millie. Her place is the corner of 81st Street and Amsterdam Avenue in Manhattan. Her thing is stand-up comedy. Person, Place, Thing, hosted by Randy Cohen, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
Coming up next on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, The Book Nook.